WVUA-FM, Tuscaloosa.
Any opinions expressed in this program are those of the host and do not represent the thoughts or opinions of 90.7 WVUA or the University of Alabama.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Season 4, Episode 1 of Pulse of the Nation. It's the season premiere. I'm Braden Vick. As always, I am the host of Pulse of the Nation, and we are going to be taking a look at the nation's most important political stories. Now, I haven't talked to y'all since April, and let's just say since April, there have been quite a few major political stories. So let's get the obvious out of the way. Joe Biden is no longer the Democratic nominee for president. That is a situation that hasn't happened in 60 years. Right? Let's just start there. That is one of the biggest political developments in modern American history. Right? Let's just take a step back and just sort of realize the really insane moment in the historical context that we live in. All right, so if only I was here, right, to record these episodes during the summer. Like, of course, you know, like, I get out of school for the summer, go back home, and then the most insane things happen, right? So let's just begin on June 27th, 2024, right? First presidential debate, Atlanta, Georgia, Joe Biden versus Donald Trump. And to say that Joe Biden had a bad debate performance would be maybe to say that the Carolina Panthers didn't have a great week one. It is one of the grossest understatements you could ever make. What I saw from Biden, oh God. And this is me saying that, coming from someone that has thought Joe Biden was the favorite, you know, before that and even after the debate performance. And I'll get to why I had thought that until around like July the 4th, when I thought, you know, he was good to stay in. But oh my God, the first 15 minutes of that, I do not blame anybody for thinking that the election was wrapped up then and there. Because this is like, bruh, like, I understand, you know, the guy on the other side is Donald Trump. And he still is. We'll get to more developments about him in a second. But I don't think you can blame anybody just watching the debate and thinking the majority of Americans aren't going to vote for this guy, Joe Biden, after the first 15 minutes. I mean, Lord. Yeah, beating Medicare. We beat Medicare, everybody. Oh, Lord. Man, oh man. That was a time. That was a period in time, I will say that. And the thing is, right, it's not that Donald Trump had a good debate performance. He had a bad performance. Like, it was not pretty from Trump, but I don't know how Joe Biden managed it. But I don't know what they gave him before the debate. Apparently he had a cold or something. I don't know. They had some sort of like dark Brandon, you know, branded water or something that he drank. I don't know what he had in the system. I don't know if he's just visibly aging or not up to it or like whatnot, but oh my God. That was pitiful. Like, I'm not gonna lie. That was pitiful. And I will be speaking about more pitiful debate performances soon, like more towards the end of the episode. But oh wow. That was awful. Right? And so pretty much every single mainstream media outlet, I guess except for the Philadelphia Inquirer, who called on Trump to drop out instead, pretty much everybody in media wanted Biden gone. Right? And the reason why I thought Biden was good to stay in is just like, because debates don't matter. You know, Mitt Romney destroyed Barack Obama in the first presidential debate in 2012, in one of the presidential debates there. I think it was in October, and it didn't matter. Barack Obama ended up winning. Hillary Clinton beat Donald Trump in all three of the debates as voted on by the American public. Clinton still lost to Trump. So, And Joe Biden beat Trump in most of the debates in 2020, and Joe Biden barely won his presidential election. So it's just like, for me, I'm thinking, these debates don't exactly matter. And I'm still I'm still vindicated in saying that these debates don't matter. Because the debates themselves, I don't think, matter. The media's reaction matters. And how the media reacted to whatever that was from Joe Biden. Oh my God. Like, I will say this. I do firmly believe that, you know, there is a lot of, let's just say there's been a lot of beef between the Biden White House and mainstream media, especially A.G. Sulzberger in the New York Times. I think I kind of explained this in like past episodes, but I mean, really, the point is, you know, Biden defenders, Biden White House, all things like, oh, because we won't give the New York Times their vaunted, you know, exclusive interview, that means they want it out on us. They want to get Donald Trump in office because he would get them ratings, he would get them views, he would put more money in their pockets, executives and journalists alike. That's the mode from Biden world. That's sort of where I fell in that camp. It's like, oh, the media is just trying to get Trump elected because, you know, oh, Trump's better for ratings. That was for the first week, and then, like, then the party decided. It took a few weeks. Like, this was a brutal fight in the Democratic Party. You remember, like, all these stories of these Democratic representatives and even some senators saying, you know what, I love you, Joe Biden, but it's time to go. Like, because at this point, you know, these Democrats are thinking, this guy's not only going to lose to Trump, he's going to lose badly, so badly that Democrats in safe seats and safe states might start being in danger of losing the re-election. That was the emphasis. This is like, look, this, like, the feeling was this guy can't win. And I disagree. I do think if Biden were to be in the race, he would be around 50-50. Like, it wouldn't be a total loss, I don't think, but that would be what the media thinks. Everyone would be thinking, basically, except for me and a few other, you know, deranged morons on the internet, that, you know, oh, Biden still has a chance. But, good Lord, that whole period between June 27th and July 21st, some of the most insane things were happening. And, During this time, towards the end of the saga, where you like, then Donald Trump gets shot. Like, can we, like, again, step back for a moment? Let's not forget Donald Trump nearly got killed at a rally in Butler, Pennsylvania, by some deranged 20-year-old lunatic. A guy who was the same age I am, or was at the time, you know, that, you know, he, you know, committed the crime for which he is, I mean, God knows where his soul is. Don't think it's anywhere good. But yeah, like, Trump got his ear grazed, and if he hadn't turned it, like, just before, like, we would have seen a presidential candidate, the guy who most people thought was going to end up being the president, January 20th, 2025 at the time, nearly get turned into goo on national television. Like, think about that. Like, I think we're so close to absolute chaos. Because at this time, Trump hadn't, we had no idea what Trump was going to do with his vice presidential nominee. Was he going to pick a Doug Burgum and Nikki Haley type? Was he going to pick Glenn Youngkin? Was he going to go for more of a J.D. Vance type? Like, we didn't know that at the time. And had Trump made a decision yet? No indications that he had at that point in time. So, like, if the worst case scenario would have happened, the Republican National Convention was a week after, for what it's worth. And if worse comes to worse in that situation, that Republican National Convention, oh my God, Milwaukee would genuinely have been a war. Look, the Pfizer Forum in particular would have been a war zone. Like, oh my goodness. Like, who would have come out of that contested convention? I genuinely have no idea. But hypotheticals are hypotheticals for a reason. Donald Trump survived the attempt on his life, officially became the Republican nominee, and the Republican nominee for vice president was picked. Senator J.D. Vance of Ohio. He is famous for writing Hillbilly Elegy, or Elegy, however you pronounce it. I am not sure, but he's the guy who did that. He's been a senator for only a couple of years. This is really the first couple of years in any major political service. And he gets tapped by Trump because Donald Trump's sons, Eric and Donald Jr., as well as Elon Musk, really, really, really push for J.D. Vance. Now, J.D. Vance is really a product of, you know, of Peter Thiel, this sort of, I don't know how to explain Peter Thiel, but he's trying to get sort of a budding right-wing political machine. Success stories, if you could call it that, include Blake Masters, so you know how I feel about, you know, Peter Thiel's, you know, successes, which I believe are very minimal. Blake Masters can't even win a congressional primary these days, but that's another, you know, story for another time. But J.D. Vance, right? At the point in time in which he is nominated, which he accepts the nomination, he would be favored by most God and everybody to be second in line to the president. Considering Donald Trump's advanced age, he's 77, 78 years old himself, and considering the fact Trump himself would be in his 80s when he if he had completed that term, then there would be a realistic chance, you know, if Trump were to win, that J.D. Vance would end up serving capacity as president. The unfortunate thing for J.D. is, let me not sugarcoat it. He's been the worst vice presidential pick in American history. Like, the literal worst, and it's not even close. Like, oh my God. I'm not even talking about the childless cat lady comments. I'm not talking about, you know, accusations that he only, you know, from Democrats, and he only views women as, you know, baby-making machines or whatever, you know, favoring a total national ban on abortion or anything of that nature, or any of the other comments he's made or whatnot. But I just want to look at the numbers. Like, get the messaging, get the ideology out of the way. I just want to look at the numbers. He is the most unpopular vice presidential pick out the gate in American history. Now, the one thing for a vice president. Now, vice presidential candidates don't really help a presidential candidate. Like, sometimes you get picked for a home state effect or, like, a regional effect. J.D. Vance was picked because he's from Ohio, Midwest, rural Midwesterners, white Midwesterners trending Republican. Apparently, they're going to park J.D. Vance in Pennsylvania and, like, Michigan and Wisconsin this whole time. The blue wool states. Because at this point in time, you have to understand the outlay of the map, which I disagree with at the time and disagree with now, is that the Trump campaign had assumed they had the Sun Belt lock, Nevada, Arizona, Georgia, North Carolina, and that they only needed to pick off one of the three blue wall states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, in order to win. Like, that was a feeling in the Trump camp. That was a feeling amongst most Democrats, too. So the feeling was, with Vance, you park him in Pennsylvania, you go there, you win that, you win the presidency. And most people still think that Pennsylvania is the most critical swing state. I'm not sure which one's the most critical swing state. Personally, I do think Pennsylvania's up there, though. But, J.D. Vance, I'm so sorry. Look. Sarah Palin at least helped John McCain in Alaska. I'm not sure J.D. Vance is going to help Donald Trump in Ohio. Granted, there is a very competitive, crucial Senate seat Democrats have to win to have any chance of retaining the U.S. Senate under that godly unfavorable map. And your thought was J.D. Vance might help Bernie Moreno beat Sherrod Brown in Ohio and further lock up the U.S. Senate. And if they do win Ohio, I do think Republicans do secure the Senate in the Senate race. But, I'm not exactly sure that J.D. Vance is exactly helping. The Democratic nominee's campaign has basically made a mockery out of J.D. Vance and everything that he has had to say on these random podcasts. Which, by the way, this is why podcasts are important, people. Like, I'm telling you that. Podcasts do serve at least some purpose in American political discourse, y'all. Oh, Lord. Speaking of the new Democratic nominee for president. So this is basically the weekend after the Republican National Convention. Republicans take their victory lap. It's a convention where they not only think they're going to win, but they know they're going to win. Then on Sunday, like the Sunday after the convention, Biden drops out. He just puts out a tweet. That's it. I'm going to drop it out of the race. And then 15 minutes later, he endorses his vice president, Kamala Harris, to be the Democratic nominee for president. And that's that. Biden's gone. And within the span of 24 hours, Kamala Harris secures enough support to become the presumptive Democratic nominee. And that's that. And then the vice presidential pick, I think this is probably one of the most scrutinized and Kremlinologized, if you could put it that way, vice presidential selection processes in modern American history, because this is so unusual. You know, a sitting president of the United States dropping out of his own re-election bid and having the vice president take his place. Something that hasn't happened in 60 years. I will admit, like, a lot of us that are listening, we're not even alive. And even more of us wouldn't have remembered, you know, 1968 and Hubert Humphrey ended up running against Richard Nixon. Now we have Kamala Harris. She is a Democratic nominee for president. And this vice presidential process, let me just, you know, take it, you know, down to the studs a little bit. To the beginning, you know, it's like, oh, well, who's going to be your vice president? There are a lot of contenders. There are Pennsylvania's Governor Josh Shapiro was a strong pick early on. So is Kentucky's Governor Andy Beshear. So is North Carolina's Governor Roy Cooper. And that's how you pronounce it. Cooper. Not Cooper. Cooper. All right? Got it. There was one other guy who came from basically out of left field. More of a dark horse pick in the beginning, but This is why I go on interviews, because if you're jostling for, it's like, hey, you know, you might be term limited after this year, and it's like, well, it would be nice to be the vice president. Enter Tim Walz, and he is the guy. He goes on MSNBC and calls J.D. Vance weird, and basically the entire Democratic Party runs with it to label the Republican Party as weird. And that was Tim Walz's doing. Like, he calls J.D. Vance weird, the party follows suit. Like, oh, this guy's got something about him. Then progressives latch on to it. Because here's the thing, what happens. Cooper drops out early. Because he's fearful that, you know, if he goes out and campaigns, and God knows whatever Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson might do and try to, you know, pass a lot of GOP policy signing into law and whatnot. Mark Robinson, by the way, is a very controversial, very unpopular lieutenant governor in North Carolina. He's running for the governorship against Democratic Attorney General Josh Stein. Stein is a clear, clear favorite over Mark Robinson, for what it's worth. A very clear favorite. It's not close. But Cooper drops out early, right? And there are rumors that, you know, he had the closest relationship to Kamala Harris. They had served together as attorneys general for a while. And, you know, that sort of personal connection, it matters in a vice presidential selection. And if he hadn't dropped out, there was a feeling that, you know, Harris probably would have picked him. There was dismay, reportedly, in the Harris camp when Cooper dropped out of the stakes. Then you have Kentucky's Governor Andy Beshear. He kind of flails in his media appearances a little bit, kind of stilted, kind of awkward or something. He falls off the map. So he's out. Then it's Josh Shapiro and it's Tim Walz. And there was a little bit of an ideological battle going on, that Tim Walz was a favored pick of progressives and those on the left, because Tim Walz, you know, had from 2023 to 2024, this is only possible, by the way, because Democrats narrowly secured a statewide trifecta, the governorship, the state house, and the state senate. Very narrowly in the state house and the state senate, by the way. And what had ended up happening was a whole slew of progressive and, you know, liberal policy preferences and agendas get passed. They get signed into law. A whole slew of them. Like, I c- could probably go for 10 minutes if I had them all, you know, listed out. We could read all about it, but a lot of it's like stronger voting protections, making Minnesota a trans refuge state. And, you know, there's also like increased, you know, funding for more housing and whatnot, and you know, making Minnesota more of like a state of, you know, refugee, you know, being sort of a, not really a sanctuary state, but just sort of more welcoming to refugees, you know, protecting, you know, right to abortion, and, you know, healthcare, and all this stuff. Lots and lots and lots of stuff gets passed by Tim Walz to sign in the law. And increasingly, because granted, on the Palestine issue, which is, I think, where the biggest ideological divide comes from in this situation, Tim Walz spoke of the uncommitted movement. We discussed that in season 3. He discussed the uncommitted movement as a group whose voices want to be heard and whose voices need to be heard from. Whereas Josh Shapiro isn't exactly too fond of the Palestinian side of the issue. And that's kind of what I think. Like, it gets thorny because Josh Shapiro is Jewish, and it's like, if you're online too much, or if you're like, you read like about the situation, it's very easy to say, you know, oh, they don't want Josh Shapiro to be vice president because he's Jewish, and, you know, all this sort of stuff. It's very easy for criticism of Josh Shapiro and his pro-Israel policies to veer into anti-Semitism. And sometimes online, it did. Just flat out, it did. Like, you know, this comes out about, oh, he served in the IDF for a couple months, like a volunteer, sort of a school project kind of thing. I'm not exactly sure. But it comes out he doesn't exactly have the best views towards Palestinians, gets accused of being racist towards them, whatnot. And just sort of all this comes out. Progressives really, really, really do not, and Muslims, they do not want Josh Shapiro to be, you know, the vice presidential pick. People who defend him, not just, you know, pro-Israel people and moderates, but also people who proclaim that they just want to win the election over everything else. They think, you know, okay, Josh Shapiro is the VP nominee, we can deal with the increased, you know, fervor against us from the left, just so long as we secure Pennsylvania. So one thing you need to know, Josh Shapiro is incredibly popular in Pennsylvania. Incredibly popular. Like, I get that he was running against a paper candidate in far-right Doug Mastriano in 2022. But Josh Shapiro won by nearly like 15 points or something like that. And Shapiro has built an incredibly popular brand in Pennsylvania. Lots of Trump Republicans like this guy. So you're thinking, okay, he has a personal popularity. You pick him, you lock up Pennsylvania, you win the election. But those electoral concerns, ideological concerns, that's not what, you know, fueled Kamala Harris's decision. Because there was another candidate for vice president, Arizona Senator Mark Kelly there. Also electoral, you know, concerns, you know, could help lock up Arizona. Kelly is pretty popular in the state of Arizona. He won his last election there over 5 points over the aforementioned Blake Masters. And, you know, also, you know, the veteran. You know, that could be play very well in regards to that vote. And what ultimately ends up happening is, you know, Kelly ends up finishing third in the sweepstakes. So it's down to Tim Walz and Josh Shapiro. What ends up deciding these things is, it's not just the fact that, oh, you want to win an election, but the thing is, you have to establish your rapport with them. Because it's, you're not just campaigning with somebody for like 3 months. If you win, you have to serve. You know, you have to serve with them for 4 years. You have to eat lunch with them every week. You have to deal with them. You have to have a sort of personal and social connection. And Tim Walz did, and Josh Shapiro didn't. Because as far as this thing goes, the thing with Josh Shapiro, this guy is not a number two. This guy is a number one. This guy wants to be president. People call him Baruch Obama for a reason. Like, this guy is the Jewish Barack Obama. Even the way he imitates Barack Obama, which is a good thing to do. You know, imitating Barack Obama on the campaign trail. Like, the, you know, his cadence, the way he sounds and whatnot. And, like, John Shapiro wants to be president of the United States. And he will be a formidable presidential candidate somewhere down the line. Tim Walz does not want to be president. Whereas Tim Walz was saying, you know, how can I help you? How can I be of assistance to Ticket of your service as president? John Shapiro was talking about responsibility sharing. What responsibilities will I get? What responsibilities will you have? And Josh Shapiro, that's not exactly great to build a rapport with, you know, a person who you want to be the president. And so Kamala Harris chooses Tim Walz. Progressive Shear, yay, you didn't pick Shapiro. And Tim Walz is also from Minnesota. There are some electoral benefits to Ms. Walz. You know, he's a white guy from the upper Midwest. He grew up in, you know, West Point, Nebraska. You know, I think in Cherry County, if I remember correctly. He went to Mankato State University, coached, you know, Mankato West High School, as I think a defensive coordinator, taught there as well. And it's just sort of that sort of folksy background has been really elevated by Kamala Harris and her campaign. And it's a Harris-Walz campaign at this point. You have the new signs, the new merch and everything. And I do want to say this before we move on to anything else. The vibe shift around the Democratic Party and its nominee for president has been crazy, right? Because look on the comments of, like, Joe Biden, when it was, you know, Biden Harris HQ or Biden HQ on TikTok, and it'll be like blue hearts and then people calling him a genocidaire. And then Kamala Harris's TikToks, when it's Kamala HQ, completely different. And I want to say this. It's not just that Kamala Harris seems to be well to the left of Joe Biden in regards to Israel-Palestine. It's not just that Kamala Harris is over 20 years younger than Joe Biden. Kamala Harris is not even in her 60s. I think she's 59 years old. Tim Walz is 60. But I will say this. Most importantly, Democrats have a candidate that the majority of the party thinks can win. A vast majority of the party thinks can win and will win. Because expectations are so important. Like, a lot of people, you know, like the low engagement, like the low propensity voters, will think of this as sort of an investment. You know, just say, like, get into the business mind of something. Like, no matter which party you lean, or if you don't lean to a party at all, or lean to a third party, or whatever. But you, in voting one of the two major party candidates, it's like you don't really, like, know much about them, or maybe you don't really like them, but you agree more with them than the other. And you're thinking of it as an investment, all right? And a major part of that investment is, do I think this person can win? If you don't think that you're the candidate of the party that you lean towards is going to win, why bother voting for that person if they're just going to lose anyways? And especially for a person you don't really like regardless. Like, that was the issue with Joe Biden and an issue that Kamala Harris had brought up in private. It's not that you're losing to Trump. It's that you're losing to the couch. And that's what the polls were capturing around that time. Was Democratic enthusiasm? No. Just no. It did not exist. And that's why Biden was down so big in a lot of these polls. And now the Democratic enthusiasm is up, even above Republican levels these days. And Kamala Harris now has a healthy lead in the national polls as a result. And now a sort of vibe shift has gone from, oh, it's a certain Trump victory, to, oh, Kamala Harris not only can win, but may actually be the favorite. Now, Kamala Harris's campaign will say that they're the underdogs, but let me make something extremely clear. She is not the underdog. She is the favorite to win this presidential election. I'll get into further detail as to why, but she's the favorite. Like, no bones about it. How has Donald Trump responded to all of this, you know, from nearly getting assassinated to Biden dropping out, Kamala Harris coming in? Let's just say he's not responded well. I mean, if you take a look at the conference seat of the National Association of Black Journalists in Chicago, I think that the Republican candidacy, the party itself and the Trump campaign, is in a little bit of chaos. Because like, they're not sure what to do. Like, they built their campaign apparatus towards beating Joe Biden. That, all intents and purposes, they had a pretty effective one. Problem is, Joe Biden's not there. And now Donald Trump's acting like the Joker to Biden's Batman. And it's been very intriguing to watch. Let me go ahead and say that. The other issue with the Trump campaign is, where's your ground game? I'm looking for it. I cannot really seem to find much of it because they don't have much. They have some offices, sure. But it's like, this is a candidacy. This is a campaign that was thinking of, was trying to make plays to flip Minnesota, New Hampshire, and Virginia. That is certainly not happening anymore. I mean, you had a Trump deputy campaign manager in Massachusetts, directly just south of New Hampshire, be fired because a memo got leaked, which he sent, which directed, which said that the Trump campaign was directing its New Hampshire volunteers to abandon their efforts in New Hampshire, no longer considering it a battleground state, and to move all their operations to Pennsylvania. And this, that broke, I think, about a couple weeks ago. And I'm just sitting here, as far as New Hampshire is concerned, we'll pivot to New Hampshire for a second, because they just had a primary to nominate candidates, you know, and the governor's race, which is one I'll focus on in particular, Kelly Ayotte, the former GOP nominee for Senate in 2016, she ended up losing very nearly that election, she gets easily nominated over former New Hampshire State Senate President Chuck Morris. It's very easy, comfortable win. Chuck Morris only wins some towns and some really GOP towns in the southeast, you know, in like west of Rockingham County and whatnot. But the Democratic nomination, you know, is a lot closer, but again, it's the Southeast that ends up deciding. Joyce Craig, the mayor of Manchester, beats Cindy Warmington on the, I think, the executive council to become the Democratic nominee for governor, because Joyce Craig, I think it was like by like 5 to 7 points. Craig won most of the population centers, and that was enough for a win. So we have it, Joyce Craig versus Kelly Ayotte in what is considered to be a toss-up race. If the Trump campaign's pulling out of New Hampshire, aren't you just putting the New Hampshire Republican Party to the wayside in an election that is so very critical for their, for them, for their party? Because it's not just the governorship you have to defend. You have to defend increasingly tenuous state, you know, Senate and state House majorities, which, by the way, I need to talk about the fact New Hampshire has like 400 members in their state house. For you have 2 million people. You don't need that many. I'm not even sure like 400 for something like larger, insane like that. But bro, like hundreds of people. Like this is a state of like not even 2 million. The two congressional districts. You have that many? That's like 4,000 maybe? Like, you don't need that many. Just downsize. Just shrink it. Like, I don't know. Like, 4,000. I swear. I don't think it's 4,000. If there was a 4,000 member, like, state house, oh, my God. I don't even want to know. Like, I don't even want to know. But those majorities, for whatever, so I think it's 400, but in the state house. But it's, they're incredibly tenuous. And there is a chance that the Democrats could go from having nothing to having a statewide trifecta. And if you're just going to leave New Hampshire high and dry, isn't that just going to help Joyce Craig? Like, I don't get it. I just do not get it whatsoever. Like, I know that New Hampshire isn't a battleground state. Spoilers, it never was. It was always going to go to the Democratic nominee for president. But I don't know why you'd pull out. Like, Shannon Sharp certainly didn't. Why are you? I know Pennsylvania is a critical swing state, but I just don't get the lack of focus on the down ballot. which is all the more concerning when you consider that most of the Trump team's ground game has been outsourced to Turning Point USA. And if you've read any stories about Turning Point USA and their ground game, I think this was out of like Arizona or Nevada or something. The one I'm remembering, I think it's a story from a couple of years ago. And when they were supposed to be canvassing, some of the people were just, I think, out there in like their cars, like eating like fast food or something. Like not actually trying to canvass voters in a critical state. I think this was in Nevada. For Adam Black Salt, if I remember correctly, he lost nearly to Catherine Cortez Masto in 2022. Like, yeah, people like that slacking off on the job, and you're outsourcing your ground game to that. Especially because remember in 2020, you know, Democrats had no ground game. Just because of COVID, they didn't want to catch the virus. They were a lot more mindful of the virus than the Republicans were. Republicans really didn't care about the virus too much or catching it. They did the ground game. Republicans lapped Democrats in the ground game. That's part of why Donald Trump was able to overperform the polls so much and nearly end up winning the election. He nearly won. He didn't win, but he nearly did. People don't appreciate that, how close it was enough. But Democrats are the ones that have the significant ground game advantage now. And if I'm the Republican Party, right? Like looking at the state right now, we're in the middle of September, it's post-Labor Day, this is the heat of election season. You know, when this episode comes out, people are already gonna begin to start thinking about voting by mail. Cause like the week after this comes out, people will start voting in the general election. I think some may already have in Pennsylvania. I'm not sure, you know, and I'm not sure if that's actually like true or whatnot, but Pennsylvania in particular is going to be the state to watch early on. But as we actually start to count not poll numbers, but actual votes in this general election. And find the Trump campaign. And my coalition, like your campaign managers, Susie Wallace, Chris La Civita, think you're going to increasingly rely on low propensity voters, particularly low propensity male voters of all stripes. There's a famous quote for like, for every Karen we lose, we're going to earn a Jamal and a Navarrete. What if Jamal and Navarrete don't turn out to vote? Like, women do usually tend to turn out at higher rates than men and register to vote at higher rates than men, for what it's worth. So you're not off to a great start there. If you're outsourcing your ground game to Turning Point USA, who don't exactly have the best track record, meanwhile, Democratic local, state, and national parties, as well as the Harris Walz campaign, are putting an emphasis on it, there is a situation that arises where the conditions are there potentially for Trump to underperform his polling. And we also can't forget about the weather, because good lord, the weather. Remember the Iowa caucuses back when people thought Ron DeSantis had a chance? And it was snowing, it was cold in Iowa, and that definitely, I think, lower turnout there. But like, it's gonna be in November. Snow's gonna be happening somewhere, probably. Rain's gonna be happening somewhere. I mean, time of recording, we just got rain, you know, on Thursday as a result of Francine. So it's just like, you never know. Like, if you're going to increasingly rely on a lower propensity coalition than what you had in previous elections, that becomes a risk. Because look, Donald Trump has been the Republican nominee for president. Like ever since 2016. It's been 8 years he's been on ballots, nearly a decade. You have to wonder if exhaustion is starting to set in. And I'm not talking about the Republican base who will vote for him every election six times and on Sunday if they could. I'm talking about the other ones, the people who didn't vote in the primaries and the Nikki Haley voters. Because it's not just the potentiality of Nikki Haley voters switching to Kamala Harris in college-educated suburbs across the country, which I'll talk more about college-educated suburbs later in the season. But it's also those people who are never going to vote for a Democrat in their lives, but just do not want Donald Trump to lead their party. And if they think he's going to lose to Kamala Harris, especially, you get into a danger zone. We're just like, why would we vote for a guy we don't like and we think is going to lose? At that point, sort of a protest vote can be put in. You vote for like Chase Olive or the Libertarian. You can vote for Constitution Party, American Solidarity Party if they're on the ballot. Or you could just not vote the presidential race at all. Or in any race. Just lodge protest vote by not voting. As much as it was a danger for Democrats, it kinda still potentially is, it's also a threat for the Republicans now. And that is a danger that I don't think that Trump and his team are reckoning with right now. Because in their eyes, they think they have the votes. They think they've had the votes for months. It just, in their eyes, if there's no fraud, there's no chance we lose. But what if you do? What if you do? Because one thing to remember is that Donald Trump isn't just running to be president. He's got a lot of criminal cases on his back. He's thinking, oh, I'll beat the cases until Election Day. If I can win the election, I can get these cases off my back and do whatever I want to do as president. But what if you lose? What if you lose? I think Donald Trump is sort of kind of come to almost, he doesn't want to come to terms with it, but he's definitely thought about it. You know, especially in the wake of his own mortality. Like, what if I lose? What if all of this is for naught? That's a thing that'll tear out, because so you get desperate. You know, no taxes on overtime pay, no taxes on tips or whatever. You start to get desperate, throw out things, this, and that. Like, I'm going to vote for the, you know, legalization of marijuana referendum, you know. I'm going to imply I'm going to vote for Amendment 4 and then backtrack when pro-life groups start hunting me down for it. Which, that's another thing. It's kind of an awkward tightrope, you know, around abortion, because I'm not sure Donald Trump actually opposes abortion personally. And pro-life groups and organizers do. So that's just been kind of a weird subplot. And where that leaves us now is a state of the race right now. Essentially, the week before people start voting in earnest, voting by mail, you know, military ballots, whatnot. It's crunch time, people. It's crunch time. You know, it's starting to be campaign season. People going out multiple rallies a day. On Thursday, Kamala Harris did rallies in Charlotte and Greensboro, North Carolina. On September 18th, Trump's going to do a rally in Uniondale, New York, which you might be thinking, why on God's green earth is Trump doing a rally in New York? Do they still think they can flip New York? No. The reason for he's having that rally there is to try and save Representative Anthony Desposito, New York's 4th congressional district. That's, I think, the most Biden voting district that Republicans hold. You can thank Kathy Hochul and Jay Jacobs of the New York Democratic Party for that, by the way, in 2022. I still have not forgotten that. And Jay Jacobs should, honestly, if you care about electoral competence, you should not like Jay Jacobs. But that's another story for another time. This story of 2024, this is the story of now. It's the story of in less than 60 days, you know, we are going to know, you know, how this thing is going to end. And we might not. There might be still more developments after the election, like there was in 2020. There probably will be. But at least know who's going to be the president January 20th, 2025 in less than 2 months. I know, I've been talking about, you know, 2024 for years now. All of a sudden, look, it is here, y'all. It is here. And let's just start out with something, because we have about 15 minutes before we got to wrap this up. So let's just start off with the fact I think Kamala Harris is the favorite 20. Clear favorite, but not a prohibitive favorite. Remember 2016, and even remember 2020. I think that, of course, look, 7 critical battleground states: Nevada, Arizona, Georgia, North Carolina, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. I honestly think Harris is favored in all 7 to some extent. And let me go first, the blue wall. Wisconsin is a state where Kamala Harris has been polling the best. God knows why. And I do think the polls are overestimating Kamala Harris. Instead of winning by 4, I think she might win by, like, you know, 1 or 2. But still an improvement over 2020, even if she does win by a point. And I gotta tell you why. Because Ben Wickle and the Wisconsin Democratic Party have made it a mission to limit rural losses. Wisconsin has a lot of rural white Midwesterners, and these areas have kind of been swinging to the right a little bit. But, you know, may still be a little bit more liberal down ballot, especially sort of these ballot referendums that Wisconsin Democrats have been excellent, you know, in winning. These Supreme Court, you know, state Supreme Court elections that Democrats have gotten really good at winning. See, I think literally the first episode of Pulse of the Nation, half of it was dedicated to one of those elections with Janet Persavich beating Dan Kelly. But that focus in rural areas, having these like rural field offices like Baraboo, that's in Sauk County, that's a swing county, which I'll discuss that all these swing counties more. But even in areas like Trump won by like 20, 30 points, Wisconsin Democrats likely have a field office there for this campaign. And obviously, there's state legislative elections. You have new maps, which were drawn up, which should be, you know, more representative of the Wisconsin polity. You know, Democrats thinking, oh, we have a chance to, you know, if obviously break, you know, any Republican chance at a supermajority, but maybe grab a chamber or two. And these real spirited races, Wisconsin Democrats running across the state. And Ben Wickler, you know, would be thinking, no, we hold these rural losses down while continuing to gain in Madison and Dane County, continuing to gain in Wisconsin and Milwaukee suburbs, you know, Waukesha, Washington, and Ozaukee counties. You know, in those areas, the college-educated suburbs, historically German, historically some of the most conservative in the state and the nation, and they've been swinging left, especially Ozaukee and Waukesha, which are the two to really focus on, especially Ozaukee. That probably will be competitive if GOP leading. In fact, you say that about Ozaukee, though. Whew. Not exactly a good place to be, you know, especially in regard to like 2028, 2032, especially if you're an Ozaukee County Republican. Oof, man. Oof. But obviously, there's a U.S. Senate race there. Incumbent Senator Tammy Baldwin should be Eric Hovde. And Tammy Baldwin's a strong incumbent. Eric Hovde is not exactly, I don't think, the best candidate electorally Republicans could have put up. But he runs primary overwhelmingly. So there is that. You'll probably still lose to Tammy Baldwin convincingly. And then there's Michigan. You know, Michigan has been a lot in news because that's where Dearborn is. That's where Hamtramck is. Lots of Muslims. You know, the theory is, oh, you know, Kamala Harris is going to lose because they're going to protest the Democratic Party over Gaza. Newsflash. Those areas do not have enough votes to make up the difference that Trump needs to make up. If losing Michigan, there are a lot of other issues, both in the state and nationwide, that you've got to handle that are going to be the cause of that. It won't be because of Gaza. Like, remember, like, Biden won Michigan by like 3 points. Like, I think it was about 150,000 vote gap or something that Trump has to make up. And here's the thing about Dearborn. Here's the thing about Hamtramck. A lot of those people, you know, vote in Democratic primaries are socially conservative. And as people get stratified, you know, hyper-polarized on these social lines, where you fall on social issues. Like, I want to tell you something. 2022, Gretchen Whitmer and these statewide Democrats, they won by a lot, like double digits in Michigan. There are still like 30 to 40 point rightward swings in East Dearborn in particular, where areas with lots of Muslims, lots of social conservative Muslims, you know, they swung to Republicans. So you can win with those localized swings. And plus, let's not forget about Oakland County, Michigan. Let's not forget about Kalamazoo. Let's not forget about Grand Rapids, Kent County. Let's not even forget about Ottawa County, which is another one of those historically conservative counties now bolting to the left. Still GOP leading, but nowhere near where it was even a decade ago, let alone 3 decades ago. And, of course, you have, you know, the Lansing areas where you have to watch out for, and the Cherry Coast, you know, Grand Traverse, and, you know, those areas, you know, south of the Upper Peninsula, you know, that are going to swing left and a couple, one or maybe even a couple of those counties flip. you know, from red to blue, especially, you know, especially in Traverse City and in Grand Traverse County. There are a lot of areas for Democrats to gain. There's some areas for Republicans to gain, too, in Michigan, but people don't realize the sort of really ladder the Republicans have to climb in Michigan, including most people in mainstream media. They get paid very well for their political analysis. I'm going to tell you, a lot of it's not up to par, and I'm being nice. So let me explain why I would think Kamala Harris is favored in Pennsylvania. Because, let's be quite frank, Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania, the suburbs in particular, it's not just Allegheny County, Philadelphia County, in southeast Pennsylvania, it's also Chester, it's Delaware, it's Montgomery, to a lesser extent, Bucks. If you look at south central Pennsylvania, Dauphin County, Harrisburg is becoming a Democratic stronghold. Cumberland County to the west is becoming competitive. And even in like areas like Lancaster and York, Democrats are starting to gain. There is a highly competitive congressional district there. Pennsylvania's 10th. We have Scott Perry, the former chair of the House Freedom Caucus. He's running against, I think, a TV anchor and Janelle Stelson. And that race has gone under the radar, but that could become very competitive. Obviously, a Pennsylvania 17th in like Beaver and parts of Allegheny counties, and then Pennsylvania's 8th congressional district in the northeast of the state, which are also going to be highly competitive. Well, Pennsylvania 7th as well, below the 8th, that would be highly competitive as well. To look at Allentown, you have to look at Easton, to look at even like towns like State College and Erie County is going to be very competitive again, toss up. But Kamala Harris, I think, you know, looking at the polling, looking at actual elections or where they indicate things might be going, I think Harris is up by a couple in Pennsylvania. As far as Georgia is concerned, this is one of Trump's best polling states. Why do I think Kamala Harris is up in Georgia? Simple. Atlanta. It's simple. It's Atlanta. The southern suburbs are becoming blacker. The northern suburbs, a lot of are becoming more diverse. They're very college educated. Like, you can't think that Trump is going to win Georgia without expecting him to get a really generational rightward shift among black voters. And I don't think that's going to happen. So I think the polls are underestimating Kamala Harris in Georgia. Think also in Arizona, because again, a lot of college-educated suburbs. For Trump to win Arizona, he need like another like 10-20 point rightward swing amongst Latino voters. And spoilers, it's not going to happen. And I'm not just talking about Phoenix or the East Valley. I'm talking Tucson's Flagstaff as well. Like, Trump would probably also need a significant rightward shift amongst Native American voters, which not as actually is going to happen either. So if polls are underestimating her in Arizona as well. Nevada is worth being tricky. I think Harris is up. I only think she's up by a point. I really think Nevada is one of the best opportunities for Republicans to flip a state as far as a presidential election goes. Low college education rates. You know, if Republicans are getting, you know, generational swings amongst like black voters, like more swings amongst Latino voters or Asian voters, then we felt in Nevada, especially in Clark County. You know, a lot of these, you know, suburbs and exurbs, like you would have to find that there. But an increasing problem for the Republican county will be in Reno and in Sparks and Washoe County. Yeah, because here's the thing about Nevada. You have Washoe County in the northwest, a ton of not very populated, R by 60 rurals. And then there's Clark County. Clark County dominates the states where Las Vegas is and the metro, completely dominates the state's politics and whatnot. Then you have Reno. That's becoming more and more of a Democratic base, even though the county is still pretty competitive. And that's been able to keep Democrats afloat, mostly in Nevada. Like, because if Washoe becomes a bit bluer, you can offset some losses in Clark County. Not a lot, but offset some. Sometimes you need to offset some losses in order to win the state. Plus, the Reed machine is still around. You know, the Culinary Union and whatnot. So that's why I have Harris in their favor in Nevada. As far as North Carolina is concerned, I've got to tell you, North Carolina, that is the state that Democrats are trying to target. And I'm going to be quick because there's a few more things I want to talk about before I get out of here. And it is going to be a tough climb for Democrats to flip North Carolina, not just because of it being a very rural state. And there are a lot of like R by 50 dense rurals. You know, Randolph County, Pennsylvania is a great example. But, you know, there is a sort of deep population in northeast North Carolina amongst heavily black areas, and those areas are shifting to the right as a result, offering Democrats less of a firewall. reason for hope and for Democrats in North Carolina. It's not just because of the new energetic party chair, Anderson Clayton, who's only, she's only like, what, 5 or 6 years older than I am, which is crazy to say. But and there's also population growth in the Research Triangle. This is Raleigh, this is Durham, this is Chapel Hill, this is that area, Cary, Apex, whatnot, Wake Forest. And that population growth has been pretty big, especially since students come back to campus. One of the things I do need people to understand is a lot of these college towns have a potential for Democrats that I don't think people are appreciating, because, like, you know, Biden got like negligible shifts out of Durham, but then 2020, because students weren't there for because of COVID. Then 2022 comes around, Sherry Beasley swings the county 5 points left, even as she loses the state like 3 or 3.5. So that's something to watch. Chatham County to the south as well experienced similar things, because it's like right next to Durham, right next to Chapel Hill. So it wasn't Durham, it was Orange County, I think. I don't know. But those college town areas, you know, State College, Pennsylvania is an egregious example of this, because there was like 5,500 less votes in 2020 than it was in 2016. That could be kind of a treasure trove for local Democrats, and every vote's going to matter in a state like Pennsylvania. So you have that. There's also Charlotte, you know, and that growing metro area, college-educated suburbs, and like even like the north of Mecklenburg, also like, you know, in eastern Gaston County and, you know, southern Iredell County, even what's like Cabarrus County, which I think is going to be a battleground, even like northwestern Union County. Those are areas to watch for large leftward shifts. And I think with that, with, you know, western North Carolina also becoming potentially a source for huge leftward gains, that's an area you need to watch, especially Asheville. There's the, you know, Democratic center of it. You know, if you take those like three really Republican counties out of western North Carolina, you know, do you have a region that narrowly voted for Trump but then voted for Sherry Beasley and her defeat? Like, there's something to that. So that's the bull case for Kamala Harris. Of course, you could also listen to Nate Silver. He will give you the bull case for Donald Trump and his model and the silver bulletin and whatnot. I think a lot of that is bunk, absolute bunk, and I don't have much respect for him. I will get to that in a later episode, however, because we are kind of running short on time. One more thing is money. Money is so important to a campaign. One of the key reasons why Biden basically had to drop out is because the money was drying up. The big donors weren't giving to him anymore. They didn't think he could win. You know, it's like, I'm not going to give to your campaign. There were Senate Democrats that had donors come up, say, them saying, hey, I'm not giving to your campaign until you tell Biden to drop out. Like, it was bad. Like, the donors were abandoning ship. Now the donors are back in with Kamala Harris. It was like, oh, he's a candidate who can win. Who we think can win. This is the important thing. And the money that has been coming into the Kamala Harris campaign, good God. It's like when she got in the race, record amounts for Act Blue in history. Tim Walz comes in, there's another bump. Then this debate that happens on Tuesday, that comes up. More basically record numbers over a 1 hour period. There's like, what, 12 and a half million raised on Act Blue in an hour? It's absolutely insane. Compare that to Donald Trump. He raised less money in August than he did in July. Here's the issue where that comes in. It's not just ground game. It's not just that Kamala Harris is making record investments in digital ads like streaming, Snapchat, YouTube, Instagram, whatnot, or TikTok. The thing is with TV, which is where the vast majority of voters get their news, because voters do lean older than the general population, is there is going to be a point where you have like 600 million or 500 million, however much you have in the bank. It does not hurt you to basically completely blanket the airways. Like, this is probably going to get released after the Alabama-Wisconsin game. And I'm going to tell you something. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are going to have ads on Fox on Big News Saturday. And Kamala Harris is going to have a lot of them. But the thing is that you can afford to saturate those markets. Because at the end of the day, you know, if you're spending like a bunch of money in like Pennsylvania, Michigan, like Arizona. You saturate those markets, those ads get less and less for what they're worth. So at some point, you have to think, like, okay, if we're up in a lot of these areas, competitive in a lot of these areas, and we have huge advantages in most of these states, does it hurt to invest in Texas or Florida? States, one of those two states, your Senate candidate might need to win the Senate, potentially, even after some, especially some brutal polls came out for John Tester recently. I think it was like down 8 to Tim Sheehy or something. Like, it might not hurt to invest in Texas. Might not hurt to plop some money in the Ohio media markets. Because who knows? You have to invest for, you know, the election we're right now. You might also need to invest in a blue wave or a red wave scenario. You have the money to do it. Why not? That ends Season 4, Episode 1 of Pulse of the Nation. Hopefully, things will be a lot more... I don't want to say fleshed out, but hopefully things will be a lot more, you know, structured, considering we have had to go through 4.5 months of, you know, material in an hour. I understand that. But next week, we're obviously going to be covering all the updates on the 2024 general election right here. What counties I think you need to watch out for. That's going to be the thing. We're going to start out with some early voting numbers, but the meat of next episode is going to be which counties do you need to watch, especially early on, to help you determine who is going to have the edge and who might win the presidential election many hours before the networks call it. Thank you for listening to Pulse of the Nation, where we take the Pulse of the Nation every week. We'll be back here next week. Thank you for listening. I'm Brandon Vick. And we have just taken the pulse of the nation.
Any opinions expressed in this program are those of the host and do not represent the thoughts or opinions of 90.7 WVUA or the University of Alabama.
WVUA-FM, Tuscaloosa.